Tom Woods Show, episode 851.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, one of the first things you figure out when you become a libertarian is that all the U.S. presidents your teachers told you were great were terrible. Learn the true history of the U.S. presidents and their crimes against liberty in our course on the presidents. Check it out at freehistorycourse.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here with Kevin Gutzman, who's back here on the show. He has a brand new book on Thomas Jefferson, published by St. Martin's. It's called Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, A Radical's Struggle to Remake America. Tremendous book. I highly recommend it. Obviously, we're linking it at tomwoods.com/851. Kevin, as you may recall from previous episodes, is the chairman of the Department of History at Western Connecticut State University. He's the author of numerous books, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, which is a New York Times bestseller, as well as James Madison and the Making of America. He and I wrote a book together in 2008 called Who Killed the Constitution? So we'll have links to this stuff also on the show notes page. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, Tom.
Well, you know I'm a big fan of yours, of course, and I love this book. I find the organization intriguing. It's not another book taking you from Jefferson's childhood to his old age. It's organized thematically according to along the lines of five areas of his life intellectually and politically that mattered the most to him in terms of what made him Thomas Jefferson and his most significant political commitments. So religious liberty and federalism and so on. So it's a very interesting treatment. And of course, even though it's published by St. Martin's, which is a totally mainstream press, of course, and it's tremendous for you, you've gotten plaudits for this book by scholars who matter. And this is all great. But I think also what's neat is that you've been able to convey a Jefferson that is somewhat different from the Jefferson that we get in popular culture. And certainly it's different from the Jefferson some people have tried to portray as I've read some people try to claim that Jefferson didn't really think property rights were natural rights or that he was a proto-socialist in some ways or this and that. So you're taking all this on. First of all, tell me about book clubs and this book and the kind of critical reception it's gotten, because it seems to me this could be your most celebrated work so far.
Well, thank you. Actually, my immediate previous book was a biography of Jefferson's best friend, James Madison. And James Madison is an interesting fellow, but his life lends itself to biographical kind of birth-to-death treatment because he's only really interesting on one score, and that is on the score of trying to implement a Republican written constitution. On the other hand, Jefferson was a man of illimitable breadth, and I think then to try to say, okay, here's where he was born, here's what his family was like, here's how he ignored his mother and his letters and so on, doesn't really leave space to give the impression of the diversity of areas in which he is of significance and of the multitude of different kinds of questions that interested him. He was somebody who would take up an issue or a topic and become so expert in it that he was the leading figure of his time. So, for example, he was, of course, a brilliant architect, just beyond brilliant. And in fact, anybody who's not familiar with his brilliance as an architect can easily go online and just Google Jefferson University of Virginia sketches and find the drawings he made of what ultimately became the central grounds at UVA, which, of course, the American Institute of Architects at the time of the bicentennial voted America's outstanding architectural achievement. He was interested in ethnography, ethnohistory, American Indians, and he conducted the first scientific archaeological excavation ever in the Western Hemisphere on an Indian burial mound near his home. He had the idea that he would prove that reigning theory was wrong, and that really the original human languages were American Indian languages. And so he gathered dozens of lexicons of American Indian peoples with the idea of writing a book about this subject and vindicating North America. He was patriotic in the sense that he argued that what European biologists were saying about the Western Hemisphere was mistaken, and really vertebrate life forms did not degenerate here. And the way that he tried to prove that this was true, the reigning theory was that every kind of vertebrate thing was of a degenerate form in the West, and that included man. And so he took up the cause of American Indians and tried to demonstrate that they were as intellectually and physically capable as Europeans. And of course, famously, I tell my students, if you want to get some idea of Jefferson's brilliance, just go into the library, find a book of his writings, pick it up, open at random, read four or five sentences, and think, I wish for 10 minutes of my life I could write like that, right? That's so what I've done in the book is, as you said, not to try to give you a life and times, but instead I've taken some of his most significant political and intellectual commitments and shown how they played out through his life. So, of course, he was famously, and I think this is the way people think of him if they think of him now, he was famously the President of the United States and the chief author of the Declaration of Independence, and scholars now generally think that he had a sexual relationship with one of his slaves, and those are probably the things people think of when they think of him, if they think of him. But he was also the most significant radical, and I use that word guardedly, he was the most significant radical statesman ever in America. So think of it this way. Historians have a general kind of thesis that dukes don't emigrate. That is, if you're born at the top of your society, you're not going to leave. You're not going to be born the Duke of Westminster and think, you know, I'd rather own a pizza restaurant in Australia. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to move there. But Jefferson did something that was analogous to that. He was born to the man who was the leading resident of Albemarle County in Piedmont, Virginia, and the chief supports of his father's and thus his status were the link to the English monarchy, the established Church of Virginia, the institution of slavery, and the feudal land tenures that kept property ownership within a very few hands in Virginia. And Holly Brewer, a historian then at North Carolina State, calculated about 20 years ago that when Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, about two-thirds of today's Virginia land was held in about 85 hands, 85 pairs of hands, 85 families. So Jefferson was responsible as much as anyone other than George Washington for severing the tie to the King of England. He was the fellow who wrote the law getting rid of the feudal land tenures in Virginia so that instead of primogeniture, that is the oldest son inheriting everything, and entail, which meant that none of one of these estates could be alienated even by its current holder. In other words, if you inherited one of these gigantic estates, you couldn't sell any of it because your son was entitled to inherit it too. That Jefferson wrote the law that got rid of that land regime, and by the time he died 50 years later, those landed estates had all broken up. He also was the fellow who was chiefly responsible for the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which made Virginia the first officially secular society in the history of the world, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. And finally, I devoted an entire chapter of the book to this, he moved against slavery. First, he made significant attempts in the legislature to put slavery on train to extinction. Then he says, when we did this, I saw that my coadjutor in it, Richard Bland, who was an older Burgess and a relative of Jefferson's, just was attacked all day long. People stood up one after another in the Burgesses and decried him as an enemy to his colony and so on. And so Jefferson said, I determined at that point the Virginians weren't ready to get rid of slavery. But what he did for the rest of his life was, first, he laid out a cogent argument against slavery. He insisted it was morally unacceptable and inconsistent with his political principles, and so he cast about for some solution to the problem of the existence of slavery in Virginia, and finally he lit on an idea that later people called colonization, which was the idea that, well, he didn't think black and white people could get along indefinitely in Virginia, and so because they were entitled to self-government as any other person was, black people had to be found some other place to which they could be sent. And ultimately, this led to the establishment of the West African country of Liberia, which was sponsored by Jefferson's former law student and political ally, James Monroe. And even today, the capital of Liberia is called Monrovia, after Monroe. The first people who settled there were former slaves, most of them, some of them native free blacks from Virginia, from the United States. So the sweep of Jefferson's reform efforts is just amazing, and it's often ignored. People don't recognize that he was a great legislator, and that, I think, is the main thing the book is about.
Kevin, I think the section of the book that I would like to spend the least time on, oddly enough, is federalism, only because there have been so many episodes of the show where I've gone through and explained the ideas of the Kentucky resolutions of 1798. So I think, I'm not saying that everybody listening to the show is the world's foremost expert on this stuff, but they know a heck of a lot more than the general public. But having said that, I agree with Marco Bassani that when you read that beautiful Kentucky resolutions of 1798, you really are getting the best, most developed Jeffersonian take on the nature of the Union. But my question is, you know, he doesn't die till the mid-1820s, and yet we don't see anything quite this radical about federalism from him between then and his death. I mean, a little, some references to it, but nothing quite as confrontational. Is that because he had second thoughts about nullification?
No, I actually don't accept the premise of your question.
Good. I'm glad. I didn't want you to. That's good.
In 1825, unhappy with the fact that the Hamiltonian tariff program had been dusted off by the new president, John Quincy Adams, Jefferson wrote a draft set of resolutions that he hoped that the Virginia legislature would pass, essentially laying out the old argument from 1798 again. We're not going to accept having the federal government exercise powers that hasn't been delegated. We think that this particular program is unjust to us, and we will resist. And unfortunately, when he passed that along to his friend Madison, as was his the chief weakness, his chief bad tendency, and Madison talked him into not being confrontational right now. So Jefferson essentially went to his death listening to Madison one more time, but he still had the old doctrine in mind. There never was a point when he didn't think that this had to be asserted, that this was a live option, that Virginia came first and the federal union was for Virginians' convenience from their point of view. And I show in the chapter on federalism that he was more of a radical in this connection than most people realize. One of the main things I hope that people will get out of the book is that the main scholars of Jefferson, the most famous ones, Dumas Malone and Merrill Peterson and so on, have tried to obfuscate this point. For one thing, Merrill Peterson edited the Library of Virginia edition of Jefferson's writings, and he excluded a lot of the main documents having to do with Jefferson's confrontational federalism. So, for example, these 1825 resolutions aren't included, and there are several of the letters Jefferson wrote about this question that aren't included in the Library of America book, Thomas Jefferson Writings. One of them is the petition that he wrote in 1797 for his fellow citizens of Albemarle County to present to the General Assembly in response to the fact that a federal grand jury in Richmond had handed up a presentment against their congressman, Samuel Cabell, for having dared to criticize John Adams' foreign policy. So Jefferson thought at that point that the Richmond federal grand jurors should be indicted for treason against Virginia. Well, you might think that was pretty interesting, but that's not in the Library of America volume Thomas Jefferson writings, even though it's, I think, about the thickest volume in the entire series, going to about 1,500 pages. And Peterson, in his book, Thomas Jefferson and the New Nation, which is has been considered the leading one-volume biography of Jefferson for nearly half a century since it came out now, Peterson says that Jefferson's devotion to federalism or state rights or whatever you want to call it was not the main element of his constitutionalism but it, or his legacy, but it was the saddest. And I don't think it's the saddest at all. It's the first thing that he was known for in 1774 with A Summary View of the Rights of British America, and it runs through everything that he wrote about the federal system from that point, 1774, until, as I said before, 1825. So I hope that people who read this book will, even if they think they know, for example, about 1798 very well, will find in it material that they haven't seen put in this context before. I don't know of any other book that gives the entire story with attention to 1797 and 1825 and various other things that are discussed in this book. I hope it's the best chapter in the book.
Well, I think it is. I made reference to the 1825 resolutions briefly in my book Nullification, but I didn't know about those until I started that project.
Right.
It wasn't like they've just been reported to me over and over and they'd become hackneyed. I never even heard about them before.
Right.
Let's skip ahead to the end and then we'll backtrack. Let's go to something that today might seem less controversial, the University of Virginia, but also Jefferson's views on education more generally. Let's start there. We often get people who support public education holding up Thomas Jefferson as a great champion. And they say, they quote all the things he says about how wonderful public education would be. And then they leave out the next sentence where he says, of course, we'd have to amend the Constitution to allow for a federally funded system or for whatever. You know, we'd have to amend the Constitution. They don't put that part in, of course. So why should I overlook this and say, why shouldn't I instead say, look, Jefferson, I get that you're a radical and you like equality and blah, blah, blah. But public education, come on now. Like, you can't use your imagination about how kids could be educated.
Well, I'm not advocating public education in the chapter about Jefferson and education. But recall what I was saying at the very beginning of our conversation about the society into which Jefferson was born. Not only was there enormous concentration of land holdings in Virginia, and again, about two-thirds of today's Virginia was owned by about 85 families. Another way of putting that is those 85 or so families each owned about 300 square miles of Virginia. So today I live in Connecticut where we have eight counties, and 300 square miles is about half of a Connecticut county. So that's as if 16 people owned Connecticut today. It was an enormous concentration of wealth, and there was no public education at all in Virginia. So we think about half of Virginian adult white males of sound mind were illiterate. And this was, Jefferson thought, like the concentration of land holdings, almost an absolute bar to an actual Republican society. And he thought the solution to that was to have kind of regional primary schools where every child, he seems to have thought at first free children, and this included girls, should have 3 years of reading, writing, and arithmetic. But when a Quaker reformer wrote to him several years after he first drafted a bill about this and said, well, I'm looking into the possibility of public education for slaves too, Jefferson wrote back and said, well, if you read my bill for the more general diffusion of knowledge, you'll see that it doesn't exclude the possibility of having slaves be covered. In fact, the language seems to include them. And I don't think there's any difficulty with that, although he said, I'm not sure that somebody who's going to be in that condition would be happier if he were educated. So he thought that was an interesting problem. But anyway, the point is, Jefferson thought if you were going to have a Republican society, the voters had to be at least literate, and they had to have at least numeracy. And then he thought, okay, after that, what do we want to come of this? What we want is not to have to rely for the sons of the wealthy to be the political and economic leaders of Virginia. We'd like to be able to kind of comb through the entire mound of Virginia humanity and cull out the very ablest people, regardless of their family backgrounds. And he thought the way to do that was to select the best performers in these primary schools and send them off ultimately to reformed College of William and Mary at public expense. Now, he thought this would be impossible to do without having the public funding the education of these not wealthy types who would be now going off to William and Mary. This is entirely a product of the time in which Jefferson lived. It has nothing to do with the idea that if he lived now, he would want the teachers' unions to be in control of every kid's education. Right? That's not what I'm saying. And in fact, one reason why in his own lifetime, Jefferson was not successful in shepherding the idea of publicly financed primary and secondary schools through to adoption was that one of his longtime political allies, William Branch Giles, argued against his proposal that what it would mean would be that you'd have primary and secondary school teachers all over Virginia. Likely, said Giles, they would become politically mobilized, and then this association of credentialed pedagogues would be the most important political influence on the Virginia government. So Giles said this alone is reason not to have public schools. Well, that's, of course, an interesting insight we might think was congenial now. So in his lifetime, his proposal for primary and secondary schooling for all Virginian children was not adopted. And the main reason seems to have been that wealthy people just didn't want to pay for it. That was what Jefferson and his political ally, Governor John Tyler, and other people in the political elite who were interested in this project thought. But famously, what he was successful in doing was getting the General Assembly to establish the University of Virginia. Now, today, we think, well, you know, Hawaii has a state university and Alabama has a state university. Connecticut has a state university. Virginia has the University of Virginia. Big flipping deal. But it was a big deal because to a large extent, all of the other state universities now are actually little UVAs. They are far more akin to UVA than they are to anything that had come before UVA. UVA was a radically different kind of a post-secondary education institution. In fact, by the time Jefferson died, the fellow who was the president of Yale said, well, you know, the University of Virginia is really the only university in America. The others are all just colleges. So let me say a couple of words about what made UVA revolutionary, and I think people will see that, yes, other post-secondary colleges, other post-secondary educational institutions in America now are almost all like UVA. And what do I mean by that? Well, first, if you were going to Harvard or Yale or William and Mary in Jefferson's day, you would be assigned to memorize particular things. And then you would show up for class and you'd be sitting in there with other probably wealthy young men, and your proctor would tell you to stand up, and you would stand up and you would recite whatever grammatical table from Greek you had memorized over the previous couple of days, or whatever mathematical calculations you had memorized. Recitation was what a class was. And this was the way that students' performance was evaluated, was by seeing how well they could recite. And Jefferson said, well, this doesn't require any thinking. We should have essay examinations. And essay examinations had never been used anywhere. And, of course, nowadays, essay examinations are used everywhere. Besides that, the University of Virginia was going to remove Greek and Latin from their prime place in the instruction of the youth. And instead, Jefferson said he would like first, he would like people to have a choice in what classes they took, but when it came to languages, he far preferred for them to be learning French or Italian or Spanish, because those might be useful. And the only use, he thought, and he loved Greek and Latin, by the way. He carried around Greek and Latin books with him all the time, all the way to his death. He would go out to ride in the morning, and he would have two volumes of his multi-volume edition of Plutarch in the original Greek in his coat. He would stop on his horse and read Plutarch all the time. But he thought it was impractical. You had to be a wealthy guy, really, to get anything out of that. So he wanted to downplay Greek and Latin, replace them with modern languages. Besides that, he wanted UVA to have, as I said before, a curricular structure that was basically free form, like Brown today, where people could come and study what they wanted to study. So if you wanted to work on chemistry or physics or biology or agronomy or whatever was your interest, you could study that instead. This was completely unknown at the time, too. And nowadays, most people who go to college are going to take some language. It's almost certainly not going to be Greek or Latin. If they had a curricular question, it would be up to them to decide what curriculum they would want to follow. There wouldn't be some mandated general curriculum that everybody had to take. Besides that, Jefferson thought that the University of Virginia should be governed by its faculty, not by politicians or not by the people who founded the place. And we take all of these elements of the original structure of the University of Virginia for granted at, as I said before, the University of Hawaii and the University of Alabama and the University of Connecticut. So I could go on, but the point is, this was completely unlike what was going on at the time, and now it's just all of what I've just said is generally accepted. UVA was also the first school in America that had a professor of medicine. It had, I think, the third, maybe the second professor of law. It was an actual university. And one thing that made it different from what we take for granted now when it comes to post-secondary school, though, is Jefferson thought, well, you're never really a senior in learning. He said, I don't consider myself a senior in learning, so I don't think we should call people seniors. And we'll just have first-year students, second-year students, third-year students, and that's what they still do at UVA. They don't have seniors or juniors. And he thought you could go for a year or two, study whatever it was you wanted to study, go back to wherever you were doing your work, and if you thought you needed more instruction, show up again. And it was going to be kind of a village that you could just kind of visit. It wouldn't be a structured four-year plan leading to fluency in Greek and Latin and connection to all the other wealthy guys in your state, which is what you would be getting if you'd gone to Yale, say, at the time Jefferson was devising this. And while he was devising this, he was in correspondence with people at Yale and Harvard, and they were telling him, well, you know what, I actually like this idea, said one friend of his who was on the faculty of Harvard, I like this idea of essay examinations, but when I raise it with my colleagues, they all said no. And actually, from the time UVA opened, I think in 1821, to students until Harvard adopted this means of evaluating performance, was 33 more years. So it was revolutionary, and all of these changes that Jefferson envisioned ultimately were going to become virtually universal.
Let's talk about, and now of course you've written a chapter on each of these two things, so bear in mind it has to be radio friendly, but let's talk about the difference between Jefferson's views on what is to become of American blacks and what was to become of American Indians, and why the difference.
Okay. Jefferson, from an early time, was exposed to American Indians and, of course, also the blacks. His father was a significant slaveholder in the western part of Virginia, which is the Piedmont region. And because he was the most prominent white man in the area, he frequently had American Indian visitors. And so Jefferson grew up with a positive impression of these people. I said before that in his youth he conducted a scientific archaeological excavation at a burial mound near his home, and he later would collect lexicons. In fact, one thing that he told Lewis and Clark to do en route to the Pacific was to collect lexicons of the American Indian peoples they encountered. He gave them a lengthy list of English words and concepts he wanted them to have the Indians translate for him. In other words, point to a bird and ask the Indian what the word is for that, point to the sky, and so on. And so he had this interest at an early point. And then because he was a man of the Enlightenment, the transatlantic republic of letters, he read widely in European biology. And the leading European biologist of the late 18th century was a Frenchman, the Comte de Buffon. And Buffon argued that mammals degenerated in the Western Hemisphere. He said that there are fewer of them, they're smaller than European or African ones, they're just less than the ones you find in the Eastern Hemisphere. And the reason, Buffon said, is the environment in North America. So Jefferson decided, well, I'm going to defend the honor of my country. And one other thing he told Lewis and Clark to do was he said, when you encounter woolly mammoths, kill one and bring it home. So people didn't know that the woolly mammoth was extinct. Jefferson expected that Lewis and Clark would encounter them and that they could bring one home for the vindication of America's honor. Well, of course, they didn't encounter a woolly mammoth, but they did give him moose, which he cut into parts, boxed up, and mailed to Buffon. And part of the reason why he envisioned trying to incorporate American Indians into American society was that he had this positive impression of them. Part of it, I think, was for this propaganda purpose to show that, well, it was a good idea to emigrate from Europe to North America. You shouldn't be dissuaded from your desire to do that by this argument that if you did, you'd degenerate, you'd become less intelligent, less fertile, and so on, as Buffon was arguing. And Jefferson advocated this in his book, Notes on the State of Virginia. He tried to show that American Indians were the equal of the white man in basically every way. On the other hand, when it came to blacks, he described them at great length in a famous portion of Notes on the State of Virginia, which is the query on the laws of Virginia. He went into the laws about slavery, and then that led him into discussing slaves' attributes, physical and mental. And then he said he hazarded a guess, but he wasn't certain of it, that they were inferior both in body and in mind. He said, but even if they were inferior in mind, that would not mean that whites were entitled to rule them. He said at one point that Newton was superior to us all did not mean he was entitled to be our dictator. So Jefferson had the idea, too, that, as he put it, the whites are prejudiced against the blacks, and the blacks hate us, and we give them new reasons every day. Here he's speaking for white Virginians. So he said the only solution that he saw to the problem of blacks and whites together in Virginia and blacks being entitled to the right of self-government as all other people were, was to find somewhere other than Virginia where they could enjoy that right. So through his political career, while he was engaged in various other acts of statesmanship he was involved in, he was seeking out a place to which expatriate black people from North America could be sent. And at various points, he inquired of the British government about Canada. He had American diplomats in Britain inquire of the British government about Sierra Leone. He thought about the idea of having Michigan or Minnesota or somewhere in the Midwest be the place to which slaves from Virginia could be sent. And he had other ideas about this, too, but the one on which the Virginia Republicans finally lit, of course, was Liberia. Jefferson thought that that was inadequate, however, and still was interested in this topic to the end of his life. Unlike other people, he was optimistic that this finally would be resolved, and he thought that it had to be resolved by the freeing the slaves and the expatriation, because he thought that if that didn't happen, there'd be a race war that could not end, he said, but in the extinction of the one or the other race. And he thought it obvious that the more numerous and armed white people would be the winners in a war. So when he first wrote at length about this issue in Notes in the State of Virginia. It was theoretical, but of course, about a decade later began on Saint-Domingue what ultimately became the only successful slave rebellion in the Western Hemisphere, which was the establishment of Haiti. And of course, one part of that story is by the end of it, every white person in Haiti was either dead or fled. So Jefferson thought, well, this just vindicates my feeling about what would happen in Virginia if we tried freeing the blacks and not expatriating them. Notice, however, that although he had this uncharacteristically negative expectation or this uncharacteristic dearth of optimism in connection with a biracial society, he did believe that ultimately the problem would be resolved and the blacks would have their self-government. So in that sense, you might think, well, that is a manifestation of his weakness of just kind of having a Panglossian attitude or Panglossian mindset. And of course, one of the most interesting features of the American story is that although slaves ultimately were freed, there never was really any significant, there wasn't widespread black violence against white people after the end of slavery. Jefferson was wrong about that. The former slaves didn't prove to be murderously angry as he thought they would prove to be.
Well, finally, let's say something about your chapter on the freedom of conscience, and just enough because we probably are hitting the limits of time for people to see the significance of this, because it seems so commonplace now that people would think that people shouldn't have cruelties inflicted upon them because of their religious beliefs. Everybody takes that as so obvious that to look back on what Jefferson and Madison had to say about it, it's kind of quaint and sweet, but, well, big deal. Doesn't everybody think that way? So in other words, I think it's made people become blasé about this.
Right. Well, as I've been writing these two books about Madison and Jefferson, I've realized how the fact that the people who are kind of short-term referred to as the founding fathers, their successes, thoroughness, makes us appreciate them less. So, for example, George Washington's on the coinage. His birthday's a holiday, although it's no longer usually even called by his name. And people don't even know why that should be. Why should he even be remembered? And the answer, of course, is, well, he's the one who established that the generals are subordinate to the civilians and the president retires, right? Those are two of the main principles of American government. We take them for granted, but look at what societies are like where these things aren't true. And the same goes for Jefferson and Madison when it comes to this question of imposition, enforcement of religion on people. You know, look at your TV any night. In America, we don't have homosexuals being thrown off buildings. We don't have fathers throwing acid in their daughters' faces for dating the wrong boy. We don't have women wearing covering from head to toe. We don't have people being made to pay taxes for religions that they hate. And why is this? Well, the people chiefly responsible for the fact that we don't have those things are Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Now, of course, they weren't alone. They persuaded their contemporaries in most of the country that this was a good idea to have a freedom of conscience. But the fact that we take it for granted just shows that we're all Jeffersonians now. When Jefferson was born, I mentioned before, he was born to the wealthiest man in Albemarle County in Piedmont, Virginia. And Virginia had a state church, which was the Church of England. And in Virginia, you had to pay for the Church of England. The law required you to attend. If you had gone out in a public square and said Jesus' mother was not a virgin, or Jesus didn't rise from the dead, or it's cockamamie to say, name your Christian dogma, you theoretically could have been burnt at the stake. There was serious force behind the established church. And in fact, in Jefferson's and Madison's time, people in their region of Virginia were punished for non-participation or for lack of support for the church. And Jefferson thought, well, this just shouldn't be. It's inconsistent with First, he argued it's inconsistent with Christianity, but his chief contention was, well, it's just nonsensical. And so in his Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, he begins by saying, God hath made the mind of man free, and then later on he says, you know, all the government can do by enforcing religious dogma on you is make you a hypocrite or a liar. So if you say, for example, as they did in Massachusetts after the adoption of the current Massachusetts Constitution from 1780 to 1833, if you were going to be governor, you had to swear that you believed in God. And so Jefferson's point was, well, okay, so some fellow has been elected governor and he doesn't believe in God. Is he going to say, oh, well, I guess I won't be governor? Or is he going to lie and say he believes in God? So has government made him into a Christian, or has it just made him into a liar? So he thought the whole enterprise was nonsensical, and he argued that, well, Jesus could have forced us all to be Christians, but he didn't. And in the end, other people in Virginia, and many of them prominent Episcopalians, people who actually were religious, Jefferson was not, they agreed with this too. They thought punishing people for their beliefs or lack of same didn't make sense, and saying that if you were an evangelical, you couldn't be in the legislature, as was true in England, that didn't make sense either. So Jefferson thought that the adoption in Virginia of this policy was one of his most important accomplishments. But another point to notice about this is he thought this was entirely a federal, a matter that should be treated federally. That is, while he thought Virginia had made the right decision in adopting this position of secularism, it was entirely up to Connecticut to keep its state church if it wanted to. So the federal constitution meant that the federal government wouldn't be declaring everybody has to be a Lutheran or everybody has to be a Catholic or whatever. But if Connecticut wanted to keep its establishment, well, that was up to Connecticut. So he had his policy preference, but he also forever came back to this federalism principle, which was the central principle of his statesmanship.
Well, Kevin, I think I'd like to get you back sometime in the next maybe couple of weeks and talk about other historians' misconceptions of Jefferson. Like, why is the Gutzman Jefferson the correct one and theirs is kind of screwy? Because there have been, as you know, varying interpretations of Jefferson's life and the significance of what he did and the way they characterize him, the way they describe his thinking it's not all the way you do. And yet I can see from the primary sources that you're right. So I'd like to know where the mistakes are. So let's do that at some point. But for right now, I'm linking to this book, Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, A Radical Struggle to Remake America, at tomwoods.com/851. And I urge people to check it out. Kevin, best of luck and congratulations on this great book.
Thank you much, Tom.
All right, that is it for today. I got to get rolling. I am taking the kids on a trip this weekend. So I hope you're enjoying the show, and if you are, please consider joining the elite as a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com and check out all the goodies you get over there. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
The Tom Woods Show, episode 856.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
To all my young listeners, you want to stand out from your peers? Then don't do what they do. Join Praxis, get real on-the-job experience and a real job. Be entrepreneurial. Get all the details at tomwoods.com/praxis. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Yes, we're talking about Thomas Jefferson again, but doggone it, there's a lot to say about him. And I still had some lingering questions in my mind after the outstanding episode last week with Kevin Gutzman, who is the author of the brand new book, published by St. Martin's, by the way, which is just tremendous for him, Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, A Radical's Struggle to Remake America. I have other questions. I want to talk about Jefferson's presidency a bit. I want to talk about how historians, in Kevin's judgment, have gotten Jefferson wrong. A lot to say today. I've told you about Kevin before. He's the chairman of the history department at Western Connecticut State University. He's the author of numerous books, including a book with me called Who Killed the Constitution? Kevin, welcome back.
Hello, glad to be here.
All right, you got this great book on Jefferson, and I'm not done talking about it, and I'm pretty sure you're not done talking about it, so here we are. All right, I want to start off with this. I have to ask you the question that would really be on any host's mind. I don't know how many books there are on Thomas Jefferson, but I'm sure it's a lot. And something said to Kevin Gutzman, I got to add another one to that pile. And I assume that part of what was saying that to you was the conviction that of all these books, whatever their merits, there's something about them that hasn't quite gotten Jefferson right. Am I right about that's why you did it?
Well, you're exactly right about that's why I did it. In fact, if you consider the main contemporary studies and students of Jefferson, like Joseph Ellis, Andrew Burstein, Merrill Peterson, Matthews in his book Radical Politics of Thomas Jefferson, I don't think any of them really understands Jefferson the way I would like for them to have done. And I also think that they tend to focus on questions about which I don't really care that much. So, for example, people always want to talk about the question, did Jefferson have sex with one of his slaves? Well, do we care about that? I guess I have an opinion about it, but I don't think that if you're going to read 300 pages about Thomas Jefferson in your life, what you want are 70 pages devoted to whether he had sex with one of his slaves. So what I decided to do was to take the main themes I see running through Jefferson's statesmanship and lay them out and describe him by reference to those, or through showing you what it was about him that distinguishes him. I think he's properly understood as a radical. He actually, you and I both are friends and acquaintances with Clyde Wilson and Brian McClanahan, and Brian and Clyde both reject the idea that Jefferson was a radical at all. I don't understand this. I can see wanting to associate principles of Jefferson's that you like with the idea of him being a conservative, but if you take even, for example, federalism, which of course is the issue that Clyde Wilson and Brian are both most interested in, he's a radical on that score. The traditional model of government is you have an autocrat as your ruler, and he's in the center, and he can tell everyone what to do. That is the absolute opposite of Thomas Jefferson's idea of the way government ought to be structured if you're going to have government at all. So, oddly, I end up immediately attacking friends of mine. But
to the amusement of the rest of us who enjoy watching these exchanges.
Well, if you look, for example, at the people who are the outstanding Jefferson scholars of the 20th century, Dumas Malone and Merrill Peterson. Dumas Malone and Merrill Peterson gave us a Jefferson who was congenial to the New Deal project. And, for example, their generation are the people who said that the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions were a defense of civil liberties. This is a complete and utter distortion of Jefferson. Jefferson's first concern in that context was federalism, was local self-government, was, wow, once again, we're right back where we were in 1774 with overweening, distant foreign authority. And actually, of course, we know that he called the federal government our foreign government at one point. And so, of course, Peterson and Malone aren't interested in telling you that Jefferson viewed the federal government as his foreign government, because they're not interested in having you think of it that way. So Peterson, for one, tries to dismiss Jefferson's concern with state rights as somehow subordinate, or his concern with local self-government is somehow subordinate to other concerns like freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is, of course, important, but it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is that people in your community should handle their political problems locally among themselves. That is the ultimate Jeffersonian principle. So it follows logically from his philosophical understanding of government, which is essentially, not strictly, but essentially Lockean, and also accepts the idea that there are some areas of human life that are pre-governmental and that government has no right to intrude into, most notably religion, but there are other things too. So I also, of course, reject Matthew's notion that Jefferson was some kind of 20th century radical. He's useful for socialists and people on the far left. That's absolutely incorrect. Jefferson was an individualist. Ultimately, he thought man was possessed of some dignity that government had to respect, and I think that's entirely contrary to the understanding of, you know, Mao and Pol Pot and Lenin and the whole freaking lot, Bernie Sanders, the whole lot of them.
All right, let me play devil's advocate here. You know, where would be the fun without that? There's no Brian McClanahan around. There's no Clyde Wilson. There's just Woods. And let me lay out what I remember the argument to be, because it's based on an article that Clyde wrote for Modern Age back around probably 1969 or 1970 called The Jeffersonian Conservative Tradition.
Right.
And what I take him to be saying is something like the following things. There are two different possible lines of origin of the peculiar set of ideas that we know of as American conservatism. And almost everybody traces them back to Hamilton. Almost everybody. But interestingly enough, Russell Kirk didn't. I mean, now, Russell Kirk wasn't necessarily a big fan of Jefferson either, but he said Hamilton certainly isn't a conservative because if all he wanted to do was tinker, and that's not what a conservative wants to do. So what Clyde was arguing was not necessarily in the whole context of the world historical moment in which Jefferson lived, was he a radical, but rather in the tradition that we call conservatism that is in the U.S., to which line do we properly trace that? And he would say, well, what were the traditions in America at the time of, or what were the principles in America at the time of the Revolution? Well, local self-government had actually been going on throughout the colonial period for a century and a half, and the Americans just wanted to keep on doing that. So you could argue that the correct conservative view is to continue with the local self-government we've already had, not to be hankering after the possibility of being a great power or of artificially hastening the establishment of industrialism or of using government to bring about the preferred social and economic system that you want, but rather a system that more or less does allow people to live their lives without a central planner. And then he would say, on that basis, we can say, and then moreover, what were the state governments looking like at the very end of the colonial period and going into the 1780s? Well, most of them had relatively weak executives with legislatures that were predominant. So maybe we say that a weak executive is also a principle that we ought to hold. And all this traces back to Jefferson as our proper ancestor of conservatism. So that's, I think, what he's not saying that obviously somebody who believes in religious liberty, yeah, in the year 1200, there's no question he's definitely a radical. And even in his own age, he's a radical for that in a world historic sense. But in America, where we don't really have a conservative tradition in the Burkean sense, but we do have certain principles that we believe in, Jefferson seems to be the embodiment of them.
Well, I think it's true that, as Emmy Bradford said, people who are usually considered conservative in America are actually Whigs. And Jefferson was a Whig, but he was a left-wing Whig. And so I would accept what you just said about contemporary America. Somebody who's a conservative is actually better advised to follow Jefferson's record of thought. But in his own day, he was radical. And what do I mean by that? Well, he's the fellow who wrote the law that got rid of the land tenures that held two-thirds of today's Virginia in 85 pairs of hands. He's the fellow who wrote the law and got it, ultimately, his friend got it passed over substantial opposition from many leading politicians, including most of Jefferson's friends, that disestablished the church and made Virginia the first officially secular society, as far as I know, ever anywhere. He's the fellow who first made it respectable in Virginia to argue that slavery had to go, that slavery was intolerable, that God was contrary, the idea of God was contrary to slavery. Jefferson also took the lead in Virginia in arguing against the continued tie to the British monarchy. I think that program amounts to about as left-wing a program as any. I once got into a dispute with Brian McClanahan about this general question, and he said, well, no, Jefferson was a conservative. And I said, well, okay, so let me list 10 political issues that divided people in Virginia. And I started with the land tenures and disestablishment and so on. I listed 10 questions. I said, on every one of these, Jefferson was left of everybody he argued with. I could point to three or four where he was left of George Mason, two or three where he was left of his friend Madison. He's left of his friend Edmund Pendleton on most of them. So the bottom line, and these weren't just incremental changes either, saying for the first time since Constantine, we're not going to have an established church. That was radical. That was saying we're not going to have the land tenures that have marked English society since 1066. That was radical, and so on down the list. Now, of course, within the contemporary American context, saying, well, we'd like to keep the principles that were established in the Revolution. Okay, I agree with Kirk that John Adams was the conservative, not Alexander Hamilton, but I don't think Kirk ever said that Jefferson was a conservative.
No, I'm sure he did.
No, so I continue to hold it to this point. And the contemporary scholars don't want any of this. They either want to blast Jefferson in a totally unhistorical way for being a slave owner, which, you know, if you're going to condemn a man for having been a slave owner, well, Jefferson inherited slaves. So he was a slave owner without doing anything. So what does that prove exactly? Now, of course, there's more to Jefferson's record than that, but that's not usually the ground on which they criticize him. So I'm not arguing for his perfection, but I think he's interesting on grounds that are different from the ones on which people study him. That, I guess, is what distinguishes my book from other books about Jefferson. I don't think that if you have time to read 300 pages about Thomas Jefferson, you want to spend 40 pages on how he got along with his daughter and his father. And, you know, I think that's secondary. And frankly, it's difficult to decide which strains of his thought to focus on in only 300 pages. He was a dynamo of thought and action. He's really kind of amazing. And I actually didn't know him as well when I started working on this book as I thought I did. So that's why I still think, having completed it, that another book on Jefferson was needed.
All right, let's pause to thank our sponsor. Hey, everybody, if you are or know a young person who might be interested in pursuing a path other than the traditional one of 4 years in college and then sitting there waiting by the phone, then check out Praxis, where you can get an excellent apprenticeship opportunity followed by a guaranteed job offer. I recently had a chance to talk to Praxis participant Mitchell Earle. Mitchell, tell me what your Praxis experience was like.
Well, Tom, for me, it was really valuable. It gave me three things more than anything. It gave me exposure, experience, self-awareness. I didn't get that when I went to college and when I started working afterwards. And for me, it really just turned everything around after that.
Well, how has it changed your life? What are you doing now? And how did that come out of Praxis?
Yeah, good question. So I was about to start my law degree and MBA program and instead kind of put all of that on halt to do Praxis instead. I moved all the way across the country to join a tech and accounting startup. Worked with my business partner through the duration of my apprenticeship and ultimately ended up, you know, moving into a couple different roles after I ended Praxis. That's where I am today. I work as chief of staff, report directly to the CEO, and I couldn't design a better job than what I have now.
Get all the details plus some free goodies at tomwoods.com/praxis. Let me ask you a quick question just about the work involved in writing a book on Jefferson. I remember I think it was St. Isidore of Seville who once said that anybody who claims to have read everything St. Augustine wrote must be a liar. Now, I don't know the exact scope of Jefferson's writings and letters, but I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot. Have you read all of them?
No, probably not. No. Actually, so far, the Papers of Thomas Jefferson Project, which started in 1950, has gotten to volume 50, and they decided they decided a while back that, well, at this rate, we're going to finish this sometime toward the end of the 21st century. So they initiated a new separate series of Jefferson's papers in retirement. And there are now several volumes of that. So if you wanted to read everything of Jefferson's writing that's in print, you're looking at like 80 volumes at the moment. And it's not hard to choose which parts to look at, you know, which parts to consider in writing a book about him. If you just kind of go through the indices and see what the subject matter of particular letters and addresses and so on is, then you can call out what you're looking for.
Right, right, right. Okay, I was just wondering about that.
Yeah.
All right, now what about when Jefferson actually got into power, taxes were few and far between, and that seemed to be the way he liked it. Yet can't we find him commenting here and there on preferred taxes that might be egalitarian in nature?
Well, Jefferson, when he became president, the chief domestic measure he was responsible for was essentially getting rid of the taxes.
Right.
So that all left were tariffs and land sale revenue. Of course, he didn't realize at the time that there were going to be so many lands to sell, but certainly he thought this was preferable to the Hamiltonian scheme of taxation, partly because it required far less by way of federal workforce than any other tax scheme. That's one reason why people favored tariffs over other kinds of taxes. Essentially, they were really easy to administer. And so I guess there wasn't kind of social overhead that's involved in, say, having an income tax like our current income tax. I'm not sure exactly which you're referring to, though. I do know of statements from friends of his about the preferability of tariffs. Actually, Richard Henry Lee also thought a tariff was preferable from his point of view because the people wouldn't notice they were paying a tariff. We might think that was a bad feature of a tariff, but I don't know if Jefferson is saying anything like that. He did think that banks essentially imposed costs on society and that the costs were widely distributed, and that's one reason why he didn't like banking in general.
Let's see. I'm just looking at a letter, Jefferson to Madison, 1785. Yeah, here, just as an example. When he says, another means of silently lessening the inequality of property is to exempt all from taxation below a certain point and to tax the higher portions of property in geometrical progression as they rise. Ah!
Yes, well, actually, he did say that. But his favorite project in regard to property distribution was his proposal in his draft constitution for Virginia that any man who didn't own 50 acres should be given 50 acres. So at the time, Virginia had these just gigantic unsettled land holdings, and he thought, well, this should all be publicly distributed. And of course, the alternative you have is today's system in which the federal government owns, you know, 85% of Nevada and half of Idaho and so on. Jefferson, this is entirely anti-Jeffersonian. So I think Jefferson's concern was that there had been these artificial tenures I mentioned earlier in colonial Virginia, and they had held land in so few hands, it's hard to wrap your mind around. One way of understanding it is Connecticut today has 8 counties, and the 85 families that own 2/3 of today's Virginia at the time of the Revolution's beginning, each of them owned land that would amount to about half of one of today's 8 Connecticut counties. So in other words, it's as if there were 85 families, each of which owned 1/16 of Connecticut. And Jefferson thought, well, this is an entirely artificial creation, and it needs to be broken up if we're going to have Republican society. I don't think this is a good illustration of the fact that somebody said something in 1790 doesn't mean that that would be universally applicable. You know, we don't know that, for example, Alexander Hamilton, who said, I think the problem for the rest of my life in federal politics will be that the state governments are too strong in relation to the federal government. We don't know that he would think that now. It's what reasonable person would think that now? So we don't have any reason to think that Jefferson thought universally we want to be dividing the wealthiest people's wealth. These were principalities that these leading Virginia families, including his own, by the way, held. I think he was right. Obviously, he was right that you weren't going to have a true republic if you had 85 families, each of which owned half of one of Connecticut's eight counties, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking that it would probably have its origins in something like that,
yeah.
That we've had these artificial restrictions for a long time, and maybe we have to compensate for that in one way or another. Now, fair enough. Now, during his presidency, you know, a lot of people will say Jefferson wasn't such a good president because of issues related to the embargo and searches and stuff like that. But what I'm interested in asking you about is something I mentioned on my own on the show a few days ago, which involves the judiciary and Jefferson. If we look at his three Supreme Court choices, they're really not that impressive in terms of, are these really Virginia-style, Virginia-school jurists who are going to rule as if they believed in the compact theory of the Union?
Right.
Are these going to be strong personalities that can in some way be a check against John Marshall? And it seems like these are huge missed opportunities unless I'm missing something.
Well, I think you're right. Actually, my next book is going to be a study of the Virginia dynasty. And one point I made in my Madison biography, which is going to be expanded to cover the entire Virginia dynasty, I think, is that Madison's appointment of Joseph Story to the Supreme Court may have been the worst appointment in history if the purpose of an appointment is for the president to have his view of the Constitution instantiated into constitutional law. I mean, Joseph Story was Marshall's right-hand man, and not only that, but he taught Marshallism to a couple of generations of law students at Harvard, which, of course, had just a disastrous consequence. So Jefferson didn't have any kind of leading light, terrible choices like Story, but you're right that none of them was really a winner. I think Johnson was not bad and, in fact, did follow Jefferson's and other Virginians' advice by beginning to issue notable dissents. He actually is recalled chiefly for that. But yes, surely. There are only two people who were on the Supreme Court with Marshall. Well, I guess you could count Chase in a negative way. So there are three associate justices during Marshall's tenure who are remembered. Chase is remembered because he was impeached and then unfortunately was not convicted in the Senate. And then you have two other fellows, and none of them is really on a par with Story or Marshall. So it's true. It's true. That's one major failing. And actually, in his retirement, Jefferson devoted an increasing amount of attention to lamenting the fact that the court was behaving the way it was and that his and Madison's appointments to that point. And I guess eventually he also was commenting on this during the Monroe administration. So the three Republican presidents' appointments hadn't changed the direction of the Supreme Court at all.
So if, as you look back on Jefferson's, not just his public life, but just his whole, just the whole span of Thomas Jefferson's life, what part of it or what episode or anything do you look at and say, either this is a real blot on his record or this is something that's curiously un-Jeffersonian?
Well, let me think about that. During his presidency, the U.S. attorney in Connecticut prosecuted a fellow for seditious libel. And we don't know that Jefferson instigated this, but we know he didn't do anything to stop it. So that is kind of hard to fathom, I think. What else? Well, the worst thing about his entire record, I guess, is his ridiculous military policy as president. We're in the middle of a world war, and so we're going to cut the Navy back to these ridiculous gunboats and denude the Army of most of its manpower. And I think the end result of the Madisonian experiment. This was Madison's idea, ultimately, I believe. The end result was, of course, that the British burned down the White House and the Capitol, and that can't be excused. What else? He also, in private, gave support to the French Revolution long after anybody else, essentially.
Yeah, that's a big one.
So I don't think that there's really anything concrete that he did in support of the French Revolution other than putting his prestige behind it, even though he was aware of the just almost indiscriminate slaughter of nobles and priests and so on. And that is hard to rationalize in any way. I'm very negative about him in regard to both his military policy and, of course, it's a component of his foreign policy, which was foolish in that sense. And, of course, he lied to Washington's face about paying for and supporting partisan newspapers to attack the Washington administration. It's the only instance I know of in which any of these guys looked another one in the eye and just told him a flat lie. Washington said, I think you're connected with this paper that keeps just impugning me all the time. And Jefferson told him he hadn't had anything to do with it. Well, he was one of the people who organized it. So that can't be excused. There are other things, but those are the main ones.
All right. Well, that's interesting stuff. I didn't know that about that confrontation with Washington and Jefferson saying that.
Right.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Now, is that something that contemporaries all knew, or is that something that we found out as historians? Hey, wait a minute. He was involved in this.
Well, Washington had heard rumors of it, and it wasn't really a secret at the time, but I don't think the general public would have known about it. So he encouraged people to start newspapers. He paid a fellow a State Department salary so that the guy would have money to start a newspaper. He was one of the organizers of the anti-federalist press, and in time, the anti-federalist press began making personal attacks on Washington, which I think were unjustified, but they were also just completely outside what people thought was normal political behavior, and Washington thought they were intolerable. So he asked Jefferson, and as I say, Jefferson lied to him.
Well, how about that?
I'm sure that Washington probably knew about it anyway, and Mrs. Washington said highly negative things about Jefferson in her retirement or afterwards.
Oh, wow. I love juice like this.
Yeah.
I don't know this stuff. This is fun to know. Well, the book is Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, A Radical Struggle to Remake America. As usual, I'm linking to it on the show notes page. Today's is tomwoods.com/856. And I don't know. I could just keep talking about this. You know, I'd like to just keep getting you, because when I invited you on this morning, there was some concern, would we have anything to talk about? And I thought, come on, man. Come on. How long have we known each other? Have we ever sat across from each other at dinner just with dumbstruck with nothing to say? Never. Never. Not ever going to happen. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Sure.
All right, everybody. Just a reminder, Wednesday, March 1st, 2017, doing a live presentation with my guest from episode 852, Steve Clayton, on e-commerce stores. This is a guy who's had tremendous success. There's nobody in the world who knows more about this than Steve Clayton. How to open your own store without having to borrow $1 million and build some crummy building. Forget it. What do you think this is, 1957? This is 2017. You open an online store. You sell people stuff that they want to buy, and you keep tweaking the audience using Facebook ads till you find a group that wants to buy it. And then you keep selling more of that thing to those people. Not brain surgery, but how many people do it? Almost nobody, because of the Tom Woods rule, nobody ever does anything. Well, watch Steve in action for yourself and see what you think on Wednesday, March the 1st. Sign up, grab your seat, because it is going to fill up at tomwoods.com/factory. All right, that's it. Tomorrow, Donald Trump and the Deep State. We'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.